So welcome all. I'm Juha Matti, and these are the demonstration sessions. So we will be going through few analytical exercises and then few computer exercises. And let's begin with the analytical one. So you should be able to see the question sheet here. In the first exercise, the first exercise is about the OLS estimated method. We're asked which of the following models can be estimated using the OLS estimator. Let's go into the first equation, 1.1. So here, as you can see, the formula, it's the standard OLS formula. Left-hand side, we have the dependent variable, and on the right-hand side, the independent variable. So we can perfectly estimate that. But then, of course, the question is, under which assumption is our estimator valid? So what are the standard assumptions of the OLS? First, linearity. Second, no strict exogeneity. Third, there's no multicollinearity in the model. That means that there are no linear combinations. And fourth and fifth assumptions are related to the error term. First, the error term is constant. The variability does not vary over time. It remains constant. And fifth, there is no autocorrelation in the model. Those are the standard assumptions of the OLS. And given that these assumptions are valid, our estimator is valid. I'll check. So then, for the sake of the intuition, I'll show you what the OLS does. So to strengthen your intuition, what happens in the OLS, I'll simulate some data. So here, this is us. Yes?
So I'm very confused about how to do this course. I didn't realize we should have done some exercises now. So would you have please given some kind of quick summary? I watched like three videos that we're supposed to watch, and I thought that was enough. But I don't know. The instructions were very confusing to me at least. Not really sure what needs to be done.
Okay.
Others agree.
Okay, so we'll take a quick pause before we continue. So let's discuss about the practicalities. So about the practicalities, passing this course is dependable on doing a home assignment. That's the main thing. So the home assignment is about applying econometric techniques, and you will learn these econometric techniques during these demonstration sessions. So doing the home assignment is conditional on the learning of the techniques you will on of this course. So that's the main thing about passing the course. Then in addition, if you want to, you can do an exam, and this exam is more theoretical and based on the lectures. So for example, there could be some question about, for example, the validity of the OLS assumption is for example, is given that these assumptions are valid. So can you do a OLS estimate? Is your OLS estimator valid? That could be a one theoretical question, for example, just something out of my mind.
And for this demo lessons, you're supposed to have done something already. And we don't do anything here, we just check.
Doing this before the session is of course helpful. So then, but it's not necessary. So you can also do it in that way that you can just come here or use the video lectures to learn things. So if you're short on time, you have the material to learn. So that's the main thing. It is there are no group requirements of doing the demonstration before the session, but of course it will be helpful. Any other practicalities? Okay, we can if you come new questions, we can continue the discussion on a break. So I'll be doing these exercises like hour and a half, and then we'll have some 5 to 15 minute break, and we can discuss the things then. So back to the OLS, what's the intuition that what's happening in the OLS? So to give you an intuition, I simulate some data. Then I calculate an equation using the simulated data. And then I'll just plot the data here. Plotting this data shouldn't be that computationally that heavy. Okay, you'll able to see the scatter plot there. So the question is, what is a OLS? What does the OLS do? It just fits a line in the scatter plot. So here, now, just looking at this picture, you can see some positive trend over there. Here's one variable, there's another, and you can see there's some linear trend in the data. So what the OLS does, by minimizing the squared errors, it just fits a linear line into the model. So that's the OLS. So let's go back to the questions. So second equation here, we have a quite complex product there. So can we estimate this? First, in order to answer that, let's take natural logarithms of these equations. And using natural logarithms, this equation is transformed into an equation like this. Can you understand immediately the reasoning how this transformation works? It's about standard rules of the logarithm. And here we can see in this equation, I can also, if you want to, I can also write you down some how it's just done, some example. Here I have like x and logarithm. It's x there on the x side. This becomes this. This, and then using a another rule, we can throw the exponent in front of the logarithm, and it will become like this. So just standard rules of the logarithm. Here in a second equation, we observe that we have a natural logarithm times the Nepper's number. So natural logarithm, they are inverse of each other, and that means if I have something on a denominator and something as an nominator, the same thing, they cancel each other out. So that becomes one. So we can take these terms out. And then we have equation like this. It's only difference with the first equation is that it's in a logarithm. So it's perfect. We can estimate it. The third equation here, the difference with respect to the first equation is that our parameter looks a little complex. It's a product of beta and gamma. So for sure, we can estimate it. But if we estimate a product of the gamma and beta, it is just a one term. So it's basically a trick. If we just rename the product of beta and gamma as a delta, it would be the same thing. So the parameter always refers to the variable it is attached to. The fourth equation, that's similar to the second one, so we can estimate it. The fifth equation here we have two variables. We have a one parameter and two variables. Can we estimate this? For sure. Just think this product of X and Z as a interaction term. So interaction term could be, for the sake of the intuition, if you have on the left-hand side, you're like estimating the returns of the Tesla stock, and on the right-hand side, you have S&P 500. So the question is whether the movements of the Tesla stock are following closely the market, or is there any excess return in this stock? You could, for example, think this interaction term X could be, for example, the Tesla S&P 500, and then this could be Z could be just some time period that is activated. So, for example, share price of this Tesla peaked. It was something like two years ago or something like that. So you could think like the time period after the stock price peaked. So that could be so before 2 years ago, before the Federal Reserve started to hike the interest rate. You could use that interaction term. So that's one and zero after a time period. So before the time period of the increases in the interest rates and after that, so you could study what's the behavior of the stock price, for example, with respect to what Federal Reserve is doing. So maybe it's easier again to write this down. Just the intuition that could be. Zeta is an interaction term. Well, hopefully you can see it. In time range, it's after 22, zero, the term becomes activated. So before that, it is zero. So it does not take into account before the period.
That kind of dependency or temporal relationship can be built up through these kind of interaction factors.
Exactly. So for example, if you want to study different time periods, estimate different times, so you have regime changes inter behavior of the stock prices, you can distinguish this period using these interaction terms.
Exactly.
So if you added another term here like Z times QT, it could estimate what's happening in the stock price before that period. So you can distinguish different time periods using these interaction terms. That was a good clarification.
What is the difference between this kind of the interaction factor and if we took this at a separate value? What is the difference between these two? But we could also take, I'm just thinking like that, and just we could take this as a separate variable, okay?
Yes.
And we test that coefficient as well.
Yes.
So now I'm just relating that to the fact, to the variable that I'm testing now. What is the difference between that two then?
So you're asking if we have two interaction terms in equation.
Interaction terms, yeah.
Okay. So the example I gave, it's the coefficient before one time period and coefficient after one time period. So when the another term is activated, the other term is zero, and when another time period is activated, another term is zero and one is activated.
Okay, like if. Formula and the like an new formula in the
yes.
Excel, okay, just like that. That happens in this pattern, in this value.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
We can continue that during the pause if you want to,
okay.
But it, or if you got it, great.
Okay.
Okay, the second exercise, it's also an analytical exercise. Okay, it's an analysis about cap and parameters. So here, first of all, let's start with the intuition. What was the revolutionary idea of the cap and during the 60s? So what was the revolutionary idea, what happened in academic finance? So before this period, the innovation of the CAPM was that looking at the individual volatilities or standard deviation of the stock price is not important. Rather, what's important, how these individual stock prices vary with the overall market, so how they go move with the market, and not how they go move by themselves. So that was the innovation of the CAPM. So here, to sharpen your intuition, I'll show you a picture about efficient frontier here. So here on the x-axis, we have standard deviation that increases. That's the standard deviation of the portfolio. We have a portfolio that has a multiple stocks in it. And then we have an expected return of the portfolio. So here, the main idea is that think about this attendance portfolio there and compare it to the point there on the left-hand side. What's the difference between these points? Here, you get the same return, but here, the standard deviation or the overall volatility of your portfolio is smaller than in portfolio that's over there. So, of course, you want to choose a portfolio that has a lower levels of risk. So, why we rather want to take less risk and get the same return than take more risk and get the same return. So that's the standard idea of the CAPM and the portfolio theory. So that's our model. That's the underlying model. Here on the left-hand side, that's the excess return for the stock. So excess means the return excess of the risk-free rate. So risk-free rate is like a bank account that gives a fixed return. So just like 3%, and you get like 3% without taking any risk. That's just given to you if you deposit your money. But here, this is a return of a stock, like for example, Tesla stock. That can give you a higher return, but you have to take risk. And you know, Tesla, sometimes Tesla stocks can fall downwards, and sometimes it can go upwards. So you have to take about the risk, about the variability of the stock. And here, that's a proxy, excess proxy for the market return. So that's average market return in excess to the risk-free rate. Alpha is a constant term, and UT is a error term, disturbance term. So here, so we have estimated this equation 2.2, and our coefficient is given here 1.1, around 1.15, and then we have given the standard errors about for the estimator, and it's around half, 0.05. So in A part, some analyst comes and tells us that would you like to buy a share that follows closely market? That means that the covariance with the stock and the market is one. So the beta parameter, by definition, it's about the beta parameter with a market portfolio, and a share price is the covariability between these two two variables divided by the variance of the market parameter. So that's the definition of the beta. So analyst says that the covariance between these two variables is approximately one, and then there's no more risk on average than the market. So that means a one-sided test, that there we want to test that is it true that there is more risk in this stock or not. And yeah, this can be tested. Then we have 62 daily observations. It's over 50. We can. It's enough. It's a small sample, but we have enough observations. Then, so our null hypothesis is that beta one parameter is one, and our alternative hypothesis is that it is larger than one. And then we're asked down to make a conclusion based on this. So here, this is about doing a statistical inference. What are the different parts of the statistical inference? And there are three parts. Maybe I'll there's already some stuff there, so maybe I'll just point them out here. So in doing a statistical inference, the first thing is we have to know what is our hypothesis. What are we testing? So here, our null is beta is one, the stock follows closely to the market, And then the second is that beta is higher than one. Then secondly, we have to calculate our test statistics. And third, we compare this test statistic to the probability distribution. So before going into the third part, let's do the second part. So here we use t-stat as our test statistics, and our t-stat is calculated by taking the difference of the estimated parameter and our null hypothesis. So here it is the value given in the exercises minus one and divided by the standard error of the parameter. So doing this calculation, we get a value around 2.7. And then comes the third part, comparing this test statistic to the probability distribution. As we have a one-sided test, we use this value. And so this means our critical value in the probability distribution is around 1.7. So when we compare our test statistic to the probability distribution, we observe that our test statistic is higher than the critical threshold, implying that we are on the rejection region, or in other words, saying we reject the null. And when we reject the null, we reject the hypothesis that our share moves closely to the market. And there it is more probable, given this outcome, that the security is riskier than the market. And the B part again. So then we're asked to be, when the analyst told us that this share price moves closely to the market, the analyst was actually pulling our legs, gave us some false information. In the B part, the analyst comes again and says that Nokia shares have no systemic risk. Okay, no risk. Okay, like it said here, that the returns are completely unrelated to the movements of the market. If you look at the beta parameter there, the covariance term, that means that when they're unrelated, the covariance between the share price and the market is zero. That's what we want to test. And then our alternative hypothesis is, of course, that it is different from zero. Then we are given the values of the beta and the standard error. And here we have only 38 observations. So that's below the rule of thumb, 50 observations. And that means that when we have few numbers of observation, that there's some sampling error involved in our estimations, meaning that sampling error, that when we make an estimation, we want to say something about reality, but our sample is too small to reflect the whole reality. So we have to pay an extra attention to the error involved in sampling. So I'll go through into that one later on. Two-sided test and the confidence intervals. So again, how a statistical test is done. Three phases. One is the three questions. What is our hypothesis? Second, calculate test statistic. Third, compare the test statistic to the probability distribution. First, okay, our null is the beta is zero, no go movement between the share price and the market. And the alternative is that there is the movement if it's different from zero. Second, let's calculate the test statistic value. let's take the estimated parameter and subtract the null hypothesis there and subtract this by the standard error, and we get the value of around 1.2. Then we compare this test statistic to the critical value from the two-sided test. And given this low number of observations, it's a little bit over 2. So here, as our test statistic is below the critical threshold, we are on the acceptance regime. So here, the null stays in power, meaning that we do not reject, or in other words, it seems to be the case like the analyst is saying that there is no systematic risk in the Nokia share. Then, given our low number of observations, we have to put some emphasis to the sampling error. So here, when we estimate something, our estimation is always based on a sample. But most likely, the true value is the value we estimate is not the true value of the population sample. The true value we estimate is not the exact population value. Rather, the population value is somewhere near this value. So we calculate confidence interval so that we can evaluate what's the most likely interval where the true value is. So here, using the confidence interval, we calculate the lower value of the interval and the higher value of the intervals. And that's 0.2 is our parameter value. And then we subtract the product of the standard errors and the critical value from it. And we get this interval minus 1.6. And plus 0.6. So this confidence interval means, given that here we are using 95% confidence, this interval here means, or the interpretation of this interval is that we can be 95% certain that the true value, what we are interested in, lies in within this interval. And if we use a 99% confidence interval, the interval becomes a little bit more stretched in both directions. So for example, here in Finland, we have a presidential election coming up, and there are different kind of gallops all the time, and taking some percentages about how favored some applicants are. So if you look at these gallops, just think in this way, that this is the estimated value that they gave, but the true value is somewhere. The true value could be a little bit higher, or a little bit smaller, this value. But this precise value that is given is the most likely single value, even though it's more probable that it's somewhere near this value, the true value. And it's not exactly the population value, it's not exactly this sample value that the Gallup gives. So that's the meaning of the sampling error. So that was the second exercise, and then let's go to the third exercise. So let's do the third one, and then we'll have a small break. Okay, now you can see, so RStudio is shared. So the fourth exercise, it's about hedge ratios using OLS. Okay, the analyst comes again and says, okay, that was just to analyze rather that there's no one is selling their anything. So we're asked to analyze a situation where the investor wishes to hedge a long position in S&P 500. Long position means that I've bought something and I expect that the price is to increase so that I can sell it somewhere later. So I have expectations forward to the future. But as the share prices can go either up or down, I want to hedge my position from the bad possible outcome. So we're asked to use previous formulas given. So let's go into steps involved here. The first is about loading the data. Okay, here I'll take a step back. So for example, I like to highlight different lines here, how this can be done using R. So here I'll press control and use the arrow keys. So excuse me, I'll press shift and use arrow keys. So just press shift and press it. Just press shift and use the arrow keys. You can highlight different lines there. And how, if you want to run a command, you can either do it by pressing control plus enter. So fear, for example, I'll take the data and press control and enter. Get the path. I forgot to set the path. So here, please set your working directory. I forgot to do that. Okay, here's something. It does not recognize the code, so let's do it in another way. I haven't set the working directory this way in some while, so I'll try to remember how it is done. There should be some option here. Set working directory. It's somewhere here. It was here. Set working directory. Okay, here. So if you haven't set your working directory, please follow me along. Press the session tab and then go to the set working directory and choose directory here. And then if I remember correctly, I have the stuff here. So let's try. Okay, so that actually what I forgot was I forgot to download the data. So that was the thing. So of course we need to download the data here. So this exercise was about S&P 500. So we have to download the data. I download all the data at the same time so that everything's there. And let's see if it works right now. Okay, now we have the data. Download the data and then set the working directory so that you can read the data into the R program. Then,
which data are we using?
Which data now? We are using S and B heads. That's in a Moodle. Moodle next to the, so below lectures, there are demonstrations, and in the first folder, there's data for computer demonstrations. Go there and then download the data. Which one of these? S and B heads. It's second from below. Just a moment.
Can you remember setting the working directory? I can show you that again.
And again, just for the refreshed memory, if you want to, if your working directory is not right, press the session tab, go set working directory, and then choose directory, press that, and then go to the place where your data is. For example, in my case, it's in a downloads folder. Then, as we usually need to know the numbers, it is helpful to know the numbers of the observations. I'll use this command to calculate the rows in the data. So this just calculates the rows here. So this means that it'll give us the value of 227. Second part, we are asked to calculate the continuous compounded returns from the spot prices and future here. Let's go this line in detail so that you can understand the symbols here involved. It can look cumbersome, but it's when you get used to just looking these lines, it becomes pretty easy. So here, DF is our data. If we want to visually inspect our data, we can either press here. It'll give us the data. DF is here, short from data frame. The first variable is the date, and then the spot prices and the futures prices. So either leaking the DF, you can look it, or then just like here, writing view, you can also open the data. It's really strange how such easy commands can take so long time to compute. There's something's not right here. So that's the data. Then let's go into our line of code. Here we want to take we're asked to take a log difference of this time series. So here the logarithm refers to that. Data here is the short from the short for our data, as here. This is the DF, what's here. So if we want to choose a variable from this data, we just specify the name of the data, DF in this case, and then we add a dollar term here. So it'll choose the column named spot there. So what's happening here? DF, the name of the data, dollar sign specifies what we want to take from the data. And the spot is the name of the variable we want to take from the data. And then we have the square brackets there. So what's the interpretation of this? From two column and here, so it's actually a sequence from two to the number of the observations of all the data. So when we use a column sign here, it implicitly assumes a incremental of one. So for example, if I want to write numbers from 1 to 10, I'll just put a 1 and then, and that's about it. So the and in this in the case above, if we have 2 from n and being here 2 to 7, it'll give us the following series of numbers. Of course, here the next question is, what if we want to have like every second number, then we would have to use another function called sec. So from the number of the 0 to, let's say, 99, let's choose every third observations. That can be done that way. So here, let's read this line again. We take the spot series from our data from the second observation till the end of the series, and then we subtract the first one observation before it from the series till the second last one of the series. And then we multiply these logarithmic chain differences by 100 in order to get percentages. So that's our series. Those are our data. And then in addition, we need the date variable there. Let's subtract it also. DF data frame. Dollar sign specify something from the data, date from the second to the last one. That's our date. And then, okay, then we're, in addition, we're asked to set up this sample into two separate subsamples. So how this is done? Easy. Use subset command. Here, first, specify the name of the variable you want to take a subset, and then just specify the date before and after which you want to get the subset. So in the first case, it is from the beginning of the series till the August 2006. That's actually right before the global peak of the global financial crisis, when the Lehman Brothers went bankrupt. And then there's a period after that. So what's the underlying intuition why we want to, we have the whole sample, and then we have a subsample before one period and another subsample after that period. What's the intuition behind dividing the whole sample into a subsample? It's because we think there's a regime shift in the data. So for example, behavior of the stock prices, spot prices before the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers, and then there's this bankruptcy, global financial crisis, when a lot of banks, Lehman Brothers, for example, went bankrupt, and there was huge financial turmoil. So we want to study the behavior of the series before this period and after this period. The third part, we are asked to study the summary statistics of this series. So here, for the whole sample, summary statistics are here. So first, let's look at the median and mean. So mean is the average of all observations. And the median is that if you have, if you have, for example, 10 persons, that height of the 10 persons, the median is the person in the middle. But here, why the median and mean differ, it's like saying that if we calculate the difference between the average of these 10 persons that have different height, the mean is the average weighted average of their all, but the median, why does the median value is higher than this average value? It points to into a that some guys are in more taller than some other guys. So, for example, you could think in that way that there are few persons that are 2 meters long, and then there are more, then there's some a gap between the height of these persons, and then there are smaller persons. So these two persons, or rather the other way around, that overall this in from this group of 10 persons, there are, let's say, there are five persons that are relatively small, and then there are some higher persons. So the number of these smaller persons pulls down the mean of all the height of the persons, even though the median, that's the one in the middle, it's a little bit higher than this mean value. So this difference between the median and the mean refers to that the minimum value of the series is smaller than the maximum value. So probably this probability distribution we are thinking about is left skewed. And what does left skewness mean? I'll show you a picture. So here, negative skewness or left leaning means that there's a little bit more weight on the other side of the distribution. For example, symmetric distribution is the normal distribution, the Palisade distribution, nicely symmetric distribution. But then if there's some skewness, the distribution either leans in the this direction or this direction. Again, this is the R. So our initial observation is that the distribution is a little bit left skewed. Then let's look at the standard deviation of the series. This is a really simple statistic to calculate. So I think it's a standard deviation is 4. So this means, so what is a standard deviation? It's the average deviation of an observation from the mean value. So this says that we have a mean value, and there's and the observations of this series, all individual observations of this series deviate from this mean value. So that says that the average deviation from the mean value is quite high here. So this is like saying that our series is like, if this is the mean value that goes like this, our volatility of our series is like this. It's a highly volatile series. Then let's check the skewness by using the skewness moment. So here, our initial perception, just by looking at the values, was that this series has some negative skewness, and here by calculating the third moment we get the value a little bit lower than one. This means that our distribution is moderately skewed. If the value would be higher than one, then it would, then there would be high left curve skewness. Then in addition, let's check the fourth moment. That's the kurtosis or peaknetness of the variable, or in economics, economically more relevant way to say that, the fat tails of the series. So here, if our series is normally distributed, that is symmetric and has a nice belly shape, that has normal tails, the value would be 3. So here we have here our value is almost 5. So this means that we have a high kurtosis, and high kurtosis means that we have a distribution that has some extraordinary things happening in the tails of the both distribution. So what's the economic intuition of these tails? It's most likely about crisis period. For example, when stock market crashes, there could be like minus 10% per day. So these observations are quite rare. Those are the observations here that this kurtosis values is referring to, the fat tails, outliers of the series. So that was the S&P 500. Then let's look at the futures. Those values are pretty similar. Not much difference. A maximum value is a little bit higher. But nevertheless, there should be some negative skewness. Standard deviation of the series is probably a little bit higher. Yes, it was just a little bit higher than spot series. And then we have a little bit more skewness and kurtosis. Then let's go into the first subsample. What are the summary statistics before the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers, or the before the S&P 500 went crashed? So let's look at these values. Okay, here our minimum value is not that extreme as in the case of the whole sample, likely referring to the fact that the markets crashed after our sample ended. Also, the maximum value is not that high, and the standard deviation is not that high, implying that after the crisis, the overall variability of the stock prices have increased. And then the kurtosis is a little is smaller than in the whole sample, implying that there are not that extreme outliers in the series. Then let's look at the series after the bankruptcy. Oh, actually, before that, let's look at the future series. They should be pretty similar. So that was the spot series, spot as S&P 500 price. Then the future series. So if you're betting on what's the value of the S&P 500 in the future in the 30 days. So here again, values are quite closely attached. Volatility is a little bit smaller again. Kurtosis and the kurtosis is not that extreme. So here again, our future series is more calmer. It's less volatile than in the case of the whole subsample. That means when we take into the financial crisis into account, the volatility of the variability of the series increases. Then let's look at the subsample after the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers. So here we remember from the whole sample, the minimum value comes from this period. So when the market crashed, it's in the second subsample. And then we observe more variability in the second subsample than in the first one, and the more extreme events happen and outliers in this second subsample. And then again, the futures in the second subsample. They should be pretty similar to the spot prices. So we expect that the standard deviation of the series is around that. Standard deviation of the series is higher than extreme outliers are in this series. And then extreme outliers are in this series. So we did a whole sample summary statistic analysis and then a subsample analysis. And the difference, our intuition, just by comparing these values before and after bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers, is that something has changed. More extreme, there are more extreme events in the second subsample. And this means that when we continue with this exercise, we can bump into some problems. Then the fourth part, it's about a linear model. So here, let's look at the assignment. What does the assignment say? So the fourth part, it's just estimating a OLS, and yes. So let's do that. What's happening in this function? Our name of our function is LM, just that is just short for linear model. Then here on before is this tilde in English? I can't remember on the left hand side of this sign there's spot. That means that's the dependable variable. That's something we want to estimate. That's the U in our equation. And then on the right-hand side, we have the futures. That's our X in equation. So let's run the model and check the statistics. So let's interpret the meaning of these terms of our model. So here, and also write this here. So what our model looks like is that UT is the spot price we're estimating. R is here just a constant term or intercept of our equation. Then we have our beta, and that's the beta of the futures independent variable of our model. And then actually, that is enough. We can also put UT here. That's the error term here. But that's not shown here. So let's skip that one. So that's the equation we estimated here. So this is our alpha, the intercept term. What's the economic meaning of the intercept term here? So given that we're applying CAPM model, the intercept here refers to the portfolio performance in excess of the future returns. So if this this is the famous alpha. So if a investor from Wall Street comes to you and says, I have lots of alpha, so that means this is the excess returns he's able to extract from software. This is the alpha, the intercept term here. But in order to have in order to it be significant, it has to be a positive, and that means if we are calculating returns, we are not interested in the negative intercept. If we're interested in the positive excess return, we want to have the intercept to be positive, and then it would have to be statistically significant. So here, this is our p-value here, this column here. We can see that the value of the p-value is a little bit smaller than 0.10. So this implies that there's weak statistical significance involved here. So this is a bit weak result in that extent. But then our interpretation of the alpha, so our underlying model we used is a CAPM. So we're estimating returns using the market proxy by market portfolio. So our interpretation is that how should we interpret these intercept terms is dependable on what's the result with respect to the beta. And the beta is here the futures prices. So if we interpret this, the value of this parameter, this means that if there is a 1% increase in the future prices, this spot, there's 1% increase in X, the U should increase 0.1%. So that's the impact from the X to U. Or the co movement between the X and U.
U.
Come again.
U. Did you say U? I mean, is that this stand error term U or?
Y. Yeah. So you know, thanks for correcting me because I used the U in as an error term. So of course, so forget everything about U there earlier. So Y on the left hand side, and then. Meaning that there's 1% increase in the futures prices. The parameter 0.1 says that how the U should increase there. Positive correlation from X to U. But then our p-value is above 0.1. This implies that when we perform a statistical test of this parameter, we test that whether our parameter is different from zero, like in the second exercise, we did this X test that we took the value of the parameter, and then we subtracted our null hypothesis from the parameter, and then we divided it by its standard errors, we should get this value as 1.6. So that's the t value, and this t value, our test statistic, is below the critical threshold of the probability distribution where we want to compare our test statistics. So meaning that the null stays, we're in the acceptance regions, we're not over the threshold of the test critical probability value. So that means that the null stays in power. And when the null stays in power, that means that this parameter is not different from zero. This parameter is mainly noise. It is statistical noise in our model, but it is not different from zero. It has no statistical power behind it. So given that our beta parameter is noise, that means that our intercept likely, our intercept constant term likely refers to something else in the process we are not able to model. This means that our model is incomplete. So for example, Cap M is one factor model, but you could think it like this way. You all know the, for example, Fama and French three factor model. So this could be, this intercept term could refer to some other factor affecting our something other factor that's statistically important, but we're not able to model it. Before continuing, let's interpret the p value because it's really easy to misunderstand what's the meaning of the p value. So before we continue, let's go into statistical. Let's talk a little bit about statistical decision making. So by definition, p-value is the probability of observing an actual outcome or event under the assumption that the null hypothesis is true. So in other words, you might have or could have heard that the p-value is the probability of null being true. No, that's not the case, because the p value is calculated under assumption that the null is true. So we assume by doing the hypothesis that the null is true, but then we calculate an event that what is the probability of observing something in the data. And that means that if the p value is really extreme or really low, it is most likely the case that the null hypothesis, but most, it is unlikely that the null is true. And so in other words, when we are, our p-value is below the 0.05, we are under a rejection regime, and we say it is more likely that this null hypothesis is not true. So again, to go an example, I have a coin. I have a coin and I flip it 10 times. And each of these times I'm able to come up with the heads. So what's the probability of this event happening? It's quite small. It's about 1 promille. So what the statistical statistical thinking say about this event? First of all, we set our null hypothesis. We have a fair coin. Then we do the experiment, and the outcome is that it is outcome is really extreme. I'm able to throw 10 times what I want. So that could happen, but it's quite rare that it could happen. An alternative is that our coin is not fair. So here, as our p-value is so extreme, we are under rejection regime. We conclude from this that it is most likely the case that the coin is not fair. We reject that null hypothesis. Of course, it could be in a more deeper, so how can we be certain that it is really the case that it wasn't just an extreme event happened? Well, we repeated the experiment. We'll throw again the coin 10 times, and if the result is same, we can be pretty sure that the event is quite extreme. Then I put some few notes about a type 1 error. It refers to the false positive. So here, So again, about how to think about the B values. So now, right now, I'm referring to the case we're estimating and parameter, and our B value is below the critical threshold. So it's like, let's just assume that it's 0.01. So we rejected the null. So what does false positive here mean? That means that that refers to the possibility that even though we have predicted a true outcome in a deeper sense, it could be false. So that means that P value is not like a Bible that says the truthfulness of everything. This means that the P value can be helpful. It can provide you intuition what's happening in the data, but how to be more sure that it is something is really significant. That means that we have to do some more robustness checks to the data. If we get a positive result, in order to be sure that it is not false positive, that is false, in fact false result, we have to do some robustness checks. Like doing little statistical test a little bit different to the data, so that our result stays robust regardless of the small changes in our estimation procedure. Okay, let's also go through this example. So what if we remove the intercept term from the model? How would our results change? If we remove the intercept term, our future terms becomes in fact statistically significant. So is this a case that adding an intercept term into the model is somehow ruining our estimation? So this could be the case, but most likely it is not. So if we standard assumption is always to add intercept term into the model, and you can to sharpen your intuition, increase in weights as a y-axis and level of the education as a x-axis. So the more you take education, your average weight should increase. You do not begin from the origin. There's always an intercept. So you can, in this case, to sharpen your intuition, think of intercept as a minimum weight. And when you take more education, you get more your weights increases. So it's always standard to use intercept, but we have to interpret it in economically what's the meaning of the intercept in this model. Like in the earlier case, we did some comparison and concluded that most likely our model is incomplete and we're missing something constant, some market factor that's driving the behavior of the series. We were not able to model it. So then to continue, let's save our residuals. That's the residuals of the DAT series. And then the same analysis for the subsamples, the first subsample. Okay, so this is the subsample before the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers, before the market crashed. Just doing a similar regression, we find the statistical significance in the beta parameter, and the parameter is actually almost double like earlier. So let's look at the second subsample. But in the second subsample, we find that the beta parameter is no longer statistically significant. In the first, it was statistically significant, but in the second subsample is not. And the parameter is almost half from the full sample. So we did the analysis for the whole sample and then for subsamples and found different results. Our preliminary conclusion is that there's something happened between the subsamples, and this is related to the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers. There are two different time periods. Then the fifth one, it's about this is about hedging the portfolio. So here. We have Y returns and X returns, spot returns and futures returns. So the question is, how much would the variability of our series decrease if we used the future returns to hedge the spot returns? So let's calculate that. Those are the variances of the series. They're almost the same. So they're almost the same. And here, let's calculate the relative difference between these. So here, spot returns minus the model, the hedging, and then what we want to compare are the difference between the bots returns and the variability of our series and the variability of our model. So let's print that. So if we hedge the spot variability of the spot returns by the variability of the futures variability, our variance would decrease 1%. So it's like noise, nothing. So it's like if you're driving a car like 100 miles per hour and you decreased your speed few kilometers, the probability of surviving the crash would be minimal. So the variability using futures as a hedge is totally useless in this case by hedging the spot returns. Then let's look what happens before and after the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers. The same exercise, how much our variability decreases using futures as a hedge. Before the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers, it should be a little bit higher than 1%, but probably not much higher. Well, almost 4%. So basically, if you would sell some pension fund that I have a really nice hedge, and you saw that the variability decreases 4%, the hedge fund would look you like a fool and say, "Please go away." That ain't a safe hedge. That doesn't protect from adverse events. And then let's look what's the decrease in spread after the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers. And it's even smaller, like 0.5%. No, there's no connection here. That using future returns as a hedging to spot returns is not a good hedge. It does not protect your portfolio. It only minimally decreases the variability of your portfolio. So let's look if I have So in other words, what's the meaning of this? If you were here and you used a hedge, your variability would only marginally change. So it would be like nothing here. So and if you would go to the pension fund and say, I have a nice hedge, and pension fund would answer it, but this is the difference I'm looking to decrease the variability of our portfolio. Not like nothing. We are looking for a larger decrease in the variability. But then the sixth exercise, this is about, so when we studied log differences, we studied changes between the time series, change between the period T and the previous period. So now we switch from changes to a level. So this is, if I can show you the picture. Okay, let's try that one. So we studied changes before. So now we want to switch from changes to a level, not taking any changes, study the series as themselves. So here, our object of analysis is this, a price behavior that's drifting up and down.
What's the interpretation of type one? Here, type two is one. Does it have any kind of interpretation?
Do you refer a type one error or?
No, here. I mean, here, the type equals one. Or is it a kind of code? Like
it's code. It's so the difference is if I'm using this, it'll give only this. The type refers to the line, L refers to a line here. So I want to see the same picture as a line because it's nicer looking. Okay, here, if you want to check about the code, about, for example, in this plot, you can always, This is a helpful command. Just write a question mark here and write down the command here, and the R will give you some instructions about the code. So in this case, I use a type command there. And here, for example, if I'd use P instead of L, I'd get points. L refers to the line and so on. So this is a helpful command. Question mark and the name of the command. For example, it could be a linear model. The R gives some help manual about the functions of the about the inputs of the function. Yes, let's try to quickly wrap up this exercise so that we can have a break. So we should be ready in 10 minutes. So first of all, in levels, spot price on the left-hand side, and we're estimating that using future prices. And then, so here, futures are on the, are the X variable, and the U variable is the spot price, and X variable is the futures. So here, the parameter is almost equal to one. This means that As by definition, the beta parameter is the covariance between the x and u divided by the standard deviation of the x, variance of the x. This means that the future prices almost perfectly co-move with the spot prices when we are looking at things at the level, not in differences. So let's plot them. They should be co-move really closely. So here, the futures is the red line and spot price is the X line. It's like the futures only lock the spot price. Really close cove movement. So then let's calculate if we use the level of futures to hedge the level of the spot prices, how much would our variability of our portfolio decrease? Also, given this intuition, it should be pretty high, given this graph. It's like 99%, so it's like a perfect hedge. So if we hedge to the hedge in level sense and not in differences, the variability would almost totally go away. So this is a really good hedge then. Then let's look at the same first subsample. First subsample. Okay, we do not calculate the differences in variability here. So in the first subsample, so the previous case was for the whole sample. So this is the case for the before the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers, and the picture is the same. And then let's look what happens after the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers. Okay, to get that really quickly. So again, it looks like a perfect hedge. So in other words, it seems our conclusion is that price levels between the futures and the spot prices seem connected, but the returns are not. So this is an interesting result. If we look at the price levels of the variables, we would have the same variables. We would have a perfect hedge. But if we look how these both variables changes, we would lose everything. So this means most likely that in the case of our returns, we're missing something. It could be the case that we could improve our decrease in the variability of the returns if we just can find that out. I don't know how, but that's a research question. Then before the break, the last one, it's about F-test. So here, we analyze the significance of the restrictions in our model. So in the first case, we have a model that has two restrictions. Okay, I've probably forgot to do something slightly. I got the wrong model there. Now it should work. So here, F-test. We can study the restrictions of the model. First, what's the first thing to do in a statistical inference? It's about knowing what's our hypothesis. Here we have two. The intercept term is zero and the futures term is zero. So this would look like our null would look like that. Parameters of these. So here I use two equality signs, meaning that we test two hypotheses. So that's another way to write down. Please just ask.
What did you do to get that code work?
To get that code work.
Yeah.
So you get the same message.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so please go above. So here in the four, then just run this command again. So the underlying problem earlier was that I run this model without the intercept. So that was in the memory of the R. I had to switch this model to the earlier one. So why was there an error? That's because we estimated a model without intercept, and then we tried to study a restriction in the intercept. So we tried to do something that's inherently contradictory to what we were doing. So that's why we had to return to this model. So again, run this model again, and then go below, and you should be able to get this working, right? No.
Could not find function that was linear hypothesis. I had the same way in school as I did those, because I find the function.
Okay. Okay. I'll come. Let's look at the balls. Okay. So again, first we begin from the question, what is our hypothesis? We have two hypotheses. Our intercept is zero, noise, and futures is noise. Then we calculate the test statistic, F test statistic in this case, and it's almost free. But here, when we compare our test statistic to the critical value of the probability distribution, we get the p-value of a little bit over 0.05, so we're above the threshold. So using deductive reasoning, that means that we're on the acceptance regime. So that means that the null stays in power. So when the null stays in power, that means that our restricted model, where we restricted the parameter of the intercept to zero, and the beta parameter to zero, is better than the model than the model without these restrictions. So then, for the sake of the comparisons, let's restrict these parameters instead of zero to one. So again, we have two hypotheses. Both parameters are restricted to the one. That's our null. Then we calculate the test statistics and compare it to the probability distribution. And given the p-value here, we are way below the critical threshold, implying that it is most likely the case that these restrictions are totally useless. We should reject them. So as we reject our restrictions, that means that the unrestricted model is better than the model where we've restricted these parameters. And then only for the case with the beta coefficient, but not without the alpha coefficient. Again, hypothesis, something is restricted to one, test statistic, and comparing it to the probability distribution, we are way below the critical threshold, implying we reject the null. We reject the hypothesis that these parameters, it is helpful or useful to restrict this parameter to one. Let's throw that hypothesis away. Then for the first subsample, and let's go this quickly. The first case, first subsample before the bankruptcy of the Lehman, we've restricted the both parameters as zero. We probably get a probability distribution value that is higher than the 0.05, implying that the null stays in power. It is helpful, useful to restrict our parameters to zero, or to say in other words, our model is totally useless, because if we restrict our these parameters to zero, we would not have anything in our model. Then let's study the case. Both are restricted to the one. Again, just looking at the p-value, we reject the, our hypothesis, meaning that the unrestricted model is better than the model where we restricted the value of these parameters to one. The last case is probably like the, that previous one. Yes, we reject the null. The second subsample, after the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers, again, the null stays in power. The restricted model is better than the unrestricted model. In other words, totally useless. Then we restrict the parameters. Most likely we get again the case that the p-value is way below the critical 0.05, implying that we restrict the null. Yes, here in this case, the restrictions do not improve our model or are not useful. And the last case, again, we reject the null. So for short, doing this app test, where our conclusion was that we could immediately restrict the both of our parameters of our null. Both. So our conclusion is that when we estimated YT, we could set R and beta to zero and make an estimation. So it's like so it's like saying that our series behave as good, our model is as good as totally random error term that's moving there. So in other words, these models were useless. So let's have now a 10-minute break. So in a few moments, let's continue. So we already have done the heavy lifting, and now there are two quicker exercises left. So the fifth one is similar to the previous one. In this case, we have individual stock prices and then the aggregate index for S&P 500 proxying the market portfolio. And then we have the three-month US Treasury bill. And again, we are asked to do the similar analysis as in the previous case. Again, let's load the data. And the cap So now we're using this data, CAPM data. Again, let's calculate the number of the rows because we did need that in our standard transformations. And is again the number of the observations, and is it is 239 in this case. Then let's take all the data from the data frame. Again, I'm using to highlight. Shift plus arrows and to run control enter. Again, I've highlighted the data. Alternatively, I can just press this run button here, it'll do the same. Then let's calculate the excess returns of the stock. That means we take the returns of the Ford series and S&P 500 and subtract the risk-free rate from them. That was done. And then we set two subsamples. Again, we take the data variable and the time period before bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers and then after that. Before the estimation, let's look how what's the scatter plot between the returns of the scatter plot between the returns of the S&P 500 and the excess Ford. So it looks like it's a little bit upwards sloping. Let's plot that. There's some it's sloping a little bit upwards, but not that much. Then let's look at the series. So this is how our, this is what we are analyzing now. These are the changes in the stock prices. Here, here the black line is the changes in S&P 500. Excuse me, now I'll have to take that back. The black line is the changes in the Ford returns. And the red line is the changes in S&P 500. Just by looking at this picture, you can see that the fault returns are much volatile than the market returns. But they seem to going in the same direction. When one is going downwards, also another is going downwards, but the fault returns are more volatile. So let's calculate our model. Let's look. Let's estimate the fault returns by the market portfolio. So here, the interpretation. This parameter means that when there's a 1% increase in the excess returns of the index, the fault stock returns will on average increase 1.5%. So this means that the market increases goes up 1%, fault returns should go up 1.5%. And this result is given our p-value statistically significant. That means that that's not some noise. There seems to be something statistical power. In addition, our intercept term is equals to zero. So that's a good thing. Meaning that they're not... this model does not refer to any excess return in excess to the market returns. So the first question is investing in fault share prices a good investment? So let's adjust these returns to the volatility. So this is calculating Sharpe ratio. This will be one metric you will be using in your, if you work as a financial analyst. So let's take the mean value of the fault series and subtract the mean value of the risk rate and divide this difference by the standard deviation of the fault price. Meaning this value means this is way below the absolute value of one, meaning that this is a really, really bad investment, in other words. So if our Sharpe ratio, here are some interpretation for the values of the Sharpe ratio. If it's below one, it's bad. If it's a normal or good, it is between one and two, and then extremely good between two and three, and above three, it's excellent statistic. So this means that if you look at this picture, you could get some extra returns in investing in fault prices, but when you adjust to the higher volatility of the series, that means that these extra returns, you shouldn't take that bet. You're more risking on losing your money doing bet like this. Then let's look, has there been any change before and after bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers? Around 1.5 is the parameter. What's the value before of the bankruptcy? Maybe a little smaller, maybe a little bit higher. So yes. So before the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers, the returns were a bit higher. And after the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers, the returns got smaller. So then let's do some restrict these parameters. So first of all, let's just calculate restricting this parameter to one. So doing this similar exercise, like in the second exercise we did earlier, taking the estimated parameter and subtracting the value of the restriction and dividing it by the standard errors, we get a value of 4. That's the test statistics, and it's much higher than the average value of the probability distribution, meaning that this stock is much riskier than the market. Then let's do F testing. In the first case, we have only one restriction. We restrict the beta parameter as 1. So the question is, does the returns of this series go move perfectly with the market? We're testing that assumption. And then we calculate our test statistic that is way much below the critical threshold, meaning that we reject the null. It is highly more likely that this is not the case, that this realized outcome, we shouldn't restrict our parameter. It is highly unlikely that the movements of the stock price perfectly go move with the market, meaning that unrestricted model is better. Then in addition, let's also restrict the intercept. And again, just looking at the p-value, we reject the restrictions. Unrestricted model is better. Then the first subsample, before the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers. Okay, here our null hypothesis is that the share returns go move with the market perfectly, even though we restrict the null hypothesis that this is not a good assumption. Nevertheless, our p-value is higher than it was. That means that something has happened after the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers that has affected to the gold movement of the stock, changes in stock prices and the market, so that the connection has become weaker. Two restrictions, intercept is 1. S&P 500 is 1. Again, two restrictions. Look at the p-value, way below the 0.05. We restrict the null. The model without this restriction is better. Then let's calculate the last few cases. Here, in the first case, we have only one restriction. After the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers, we restrict the model to be 1. And the p-value is way below the 0.05, implying that we restrict the null. Unrestricted model is better, where we do not restrict the movement of the price of the stock changes and market changes. And again, if we add another restrictions, nothing improves. Again, we reject the restricted model. So in other words, what's the conclusion of this exercise? It is that we, even though the Ford share prices could give us some excess returns, most likely if we are doing that investment, we're taking so much risk that this bet could turn bad in the longer run. But if you be like some kind of a noise trader who's trying to capture the sudden short-term movements of the markets, you could do good with this stock price. For example, just looking here in this picture, if you have an hunch that okay, here now we're at the down end, I'll make a long position here, and then the price swings upwards, and then you're able to sell there. Of course, you'd make a nice return if you're able to capture those things, but it's really difficult to time the market. It's really easy to lose money if you try to time the market. And then the last exercise number 6, let's look at the instructions, what's there. Well, it's just an extended cap and model. You could say it's the ATP model. And then we are doing similar things we were doing here. So first of all, let's get the data, and then let's start doing. Then this is how we can get the data. I like to use a control and enter, but in addition, if you alternatively, you can just click the run. It'll say there's some warning, but it's just warning. Even though you see sometimes red in R, it does not mean that something is truly wrong. It could just warn from something. Okay, let's look. So here, our left hand side is the YT variable is the changes in the stock prices of the Microsoft. Then we have the S&P returns, market portfolio, inflation changes, productivity changes, some measures for the money, and some interest rate spread. Let's calculate the model. So here, looking for the statistical significance, the S&P 500 seems to be significant, meaning that if there's a 1% increase in the stock index, this Microsoft returns should go a little 1.16% upwards. But then inflation, productivity, and some credit measures are not different from the zero. They're mostly noise. And then we have an interest rate spread here. It's most likely a difference between the 10-year and 3-month interest rates. So this means that it has also some statistical power predicting the movements of the stock prices. Okay, so when we look at this model, there are these all variables that are not different from the zero. So should we keep these variables in the model, or would we do better if we just throw them away? Let's test that using the F test, the test we used earlier. Here we have 5 restrictions. This means that our null hypothesis is first restriction, second restriction, third restriction. Fourth restrictions and the fifth one. So we set all of these variables to 0. That's our null. We calculate the test statistic and then compare to the value of the probability distribution. And our p-value is 0.05. It's way above the critical threshold, implying that the null stays in power, meaning that it is probable that this outcome is the case, meaning that a restricted model stays in power. A restricted model is better than the unrestricted model that includes them. So in other words, we can just set these variables to the zero without losing any statistical power. We can run this model without these variables. Okay, so this was the sixth exercise, and we're in the end. And
when we found the regression results, and the coefficients, okay. So there also the people also was saying that now they were not significant at all.
Yes.
So now why should you do the F-test now to show to see whether it's well specified? Okay. So why do you need the F-test? I mean, is there a kind of difference that an F-test makes?
So what's the question is, what's the use for using S-test?
F-test.
So in this case. We could check our model. For example, we could do this as a robustness check. So, like in this case, I'll write that a model without those. So if I But if I'd run this model so this is the model without the restrictions, look at the value of the beta parameter. Why is this always taking 100 years? This is a little bit frightening. If this so simple regressions take so much time, what will happen if we start to do more heavier computations? So okay, here, look at this, and then let's compare them. We left all the other variables from the model, but we got almost the exactly same parameter value. So that means in other words, as a robustness check, if you start doing little changes in the model and leaving one variable out and doing the same regression again, if the values of your parameters change doing only these little changes, that's probably a sign that there's something wrong in your model. So this is a good robustness check. So I thank you all, and we'll continue on next Thursday. I will upload the next demonstration soon. And thank you also you via here Zoom, and we'll see you again.